Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently studying the book of Genesis. So open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
I'm going to announce this today. Please, everybody, help me remember to announce it on Sunday. I need to keep announcing it so everybody knows. We are having a baptism service on February 11th. That's a Sunday night, 6 o'clock, February 11th. At this point, we have three people we'll be baptizing that evening. Anybody else who is looking to be baptized, who wants to be part of that, let us know. So put it on your calendar. Be there Sunday night, February 11th. We have it up at Sovereign Grace Baptist Church in Nashville, same place we had our last baptism service. It's the same building I was ordained in. You all met Don Tyndall here on the Saturday of our homecoming weekend. Don was here speaking before Barney, and one of my just good and dear Sovereign Grace friends, and the man couldn't be more gracious. And every time he lets us use his building to do things, we always give him a gift, and he always gives it back. And so he actually said, when I said, okay, well, you know, we'd like to have a baptism service, here's the night we'd like to do it. And he said, okay, but the stipulation is you are not allowed to give the gift to the church. You're not allowed to give me anything. Last time we did an end run around him and gave it to his wife. So I have promised and reassured Don that whatever we do will have nothing to do with the baptism service. So it's just a real funny circumstance. We keep trying to give him something, and he keeps trying not to take it. And last time I had to guilt him into it by saying, you know, that is so ungracious of you to not take a gift that Christian people are trying to give you. And so, turn to Genesis 7. An interesting fact of human history on planet Earth is that every culture on the planet shares one thing in common. And it's very difficult to find commonality between every culture on the planet. For instance, when it comes to things like religious worship, not every culture uses totem poles, but some did. Not every culture in the history of the world used pyramids or ziggurats, but some did. Not every culture in the world has legends about two-headed blue elephant gods, but some do. It's very hard to find something that is universal to all the cultures on the planet. And all the cultures on the planet all share a flood legend, which is very, very interesting. Why is it that every culture on the planet has somewhere in its history a flood story? Well, if the flood that we're about to read about in Genesis 7 is true and factual and genuine, if it actually occurred, then that would be a common memory among all people groups, a story that would have been handed down and handed down among every people group until it developed into the stuff of legend for them, but they all share that common memory of a flood. Now, should we take the flood story literally? You know that so far I have argued for a very literal reading of Genesis up until now, but I have based my literal approach on the expertise of others. For instance, Ezekiel, who has a tremendous batting average prophetically, Ezekiel at one point, speaking in the first person for God, speaking of God's judgment, says, even if Daniel and Job and Noah were here when I poured out this judgment, they might save themselves alive, but they couldn't save anybody else. Well, that means that he saw Noah as being a real, genuine, historic person. You can read in the book of Hebrews, Hebrews 11, in what's classically called the Heroes of Faith chapter, you can read about Noah. By faith, Noah built the ark to the saving of his family. Well, that's a very literal rendering in the New Testament of the flood account. Peter, both in 1st and 2nd Peter, mentions Noah and the destruction of the world and the flood. And so they all took it to be a very literal story. So actually, if you're going to try to allegorize that story or say, well, it's a morality tale, but it didn't actually happen, it's a good story, it's a good legend, but it didn't actually happen in human history. If that's your argument, then you are running contrary to New Testament authors and New Testament theology, because there's actual theology built on the reality of the Noahic flood. Also, of course, in the Noah story, we're going to see a really interesting little detail, a little prophetic detail that Moses drops into the story that once we hit it, it's going to be one of those moments when we all collectively go, wow, how'd he do that? How did Moses know that? So at some point tonight, we'll get to the wow moment too. And don't let me down. You know, when we get there, I'm expecting wow. Genesis 7. Actually, let's back up. That's not correct. Let's start at Genesis 6, starting at verse 9. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man. The King James says, and perfect in his generations. And Noah walked with God. That walked with God is a particular nomenclature that was said earlier of Elijah. It points out that he was a God-fearer, as opposed to the Cainites, who we talked about several weeks ago. The Cain line, that you read that they were industrious, but you read nothing about them following after God. And then you read about Seth and the descendants of Seth, and you see that men began to follow after God. And certain men, it's pointed out that they walked with God. And what that means is that they were actual God-fearers. So Noah was a God-fearer. But before we get too convinced that the reason Noah and his family were saved was because Noah was such a good guy, Moses is very clear to point out that Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And that's the first place in the whole Bible where you see grace pointed out. And all you got to do is look at Noah's history. As soon as he gets off the boat, we're going to see that he plants a vineyard and gets drunk and ends up sleeping naked. And then, of course, his boys, Ham, ends up under a curse for exposing his father's nakedness and stuff. So you can't argue that just everything was good about them and so God saved them on the basis of how good they were. Instead, Moses is very clear to say they found grace. They found unmerited favor, and God started over with them. Noah begat three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. We talked about them a bit last week. And the earth was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. And God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. That's pretty universal sounding, isn't it? You'll notice there's no most of the people were doing badly, but there were still some good people. It's very universal. It's very much like verse 5. God saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. The beginning of all proper theology has to start with the recognition that that is mankind's natural state. If you don't start there, you're going to end up with bad conclusions. If you don't start with mankind is corrupt at his core, mankind is sinful, Paul writes in Ephesians that human beings are dead in trespasses and sins. That's the state, the spiritual state into which we're born. And so any theology you develop, any view you have of God that doesn't start with that reality is ultimately going to end up being confused. Because if you start with men have capabilities, then you're going to more comfortably be able to create a theology that says God does his part and man does his part. And then cooperatively, men get saved. But the Bible says ever since the fall, ever since Adam, that mankind is wicked and corrupt and depraved and dead in trespasses and sins. And it says it over and over and over. And those are the parts of the Bible that we humans like to read past, because it doesn't speak well of us. And so we just kind of read past it and go, well, that means those people. Those people were really bad. Except that you would have to show me at what juncture in human history people suddenly got good. In the early two chapters of Romans, Paul argues that the curse that fell on Adam because of Adam's rebellion, the curse was death, and that all men are sinners, proven by the fact that all men die. And so whenever anybody wants to argue to me that they're not that bad, I always say, well, that's fine. There's an acid test. There's a way to check it out. Just don't die. It's easy. You don't die, you're good. You die, you're not good. Now, I look in the mirror these days, and I'm a little shocked by the old man who's looking back at me, because in my head, I'm still 23. And I realize this is the curse of Adam at work. I'm getting old, I'm getting sicker, I'm getting slower, and I'm gonna die, just like everybody else, because I am, in fact, a sinner. You got to get your theology of sin correct if you're going to get your theology of salvation correct. Right here, stated twice in the most dramatic language Moses could write, he said, wickedness of men on the earth was so great that every imagination of the thoughts of their heart was only evil continually. And he didn't say, except once in a while when a little good crept in. Only evil continually is the state that God found mankind in. Now, by the way, what we're talking about here is not relative good. Because whenever you talk about man's sinfulness, people start thinking in terms of relative goodness. And they'll say, yeah, but I can't be that bad because I'm not as bad as fill in the blank. We'll use Tom. We'll say, I'm not as bad as Tom, therefore I'm not as bad as I could be, so then I must be relatively good. The problem is Tom is not the standard. The standard of comparison, if you want to compare yourself, is the perfect, righteous, eternal holiness of God. That's your standard. Okay, now compare. Well, from God's vantage point of perfect, righteous holiness, when he looks at you, does he see goodness?
No.
When he looks at you, he sees corrupt. He sees dying. He eternally lives, and he sees dying creatures. That alone is enough to say there's something very ungodly about these creatures. They're corrupt, and they're dying, and they're getting sick, and they're decaying, and all of this bad stuff is happening to them because they are intrinsically ungodly. So start with that. All human life is corrupt. All human beings are wicked continually in God's eyes. Here God decides, well, I'm just going to destroy everybody. Is he right to do that?
Sure. Yeah.
He created them.
He created them. He can do what he wants. Sure. And we get this sense, this very humanistic sense, that human beings just have enough intrinsic value that it's just wrong of God to wipe everybody out. But God, who made everybody, can do with everybody whatever he pleases to do. And what they deserve is massive wipeout. And so he does. What we don't ever deserve is to stand in his presence forgiven, undefiled, redeemed, made perfect, eternal life. All of those great, wonderful promises we have in Christ, we start to get a little puffed up and think, well, I'm getting eternal life because I deserve it. You got to get this right. No, what you deserve is God's condemnation. What all human beings deserve is the big wipeout. But if any of us end up standing in front of him, loved, uncondemned, accepted, washed, purified, you can't take any credit for that. And so the grace of God becomes big and bright and shiny at that moment, that it has to be the grace of God. And as soon as God prepared to do the big wipeout, he started by demonstrating grace. And he said to Noah, I'm going to wipe out everybody except you, not because you deserve it, but because I'm gracious. And so he can say to Tom, you're not going to die forever eternally and end up under my condemnation, not because you deserve it, but because grace. Right? Yes, sir.
It's almost mind-boggling to me. It almost feels like with all this chaos and going around above God, it almost seems like God made a mistake. I know this sounds weird. I know it sounds like this omnipotent God who has done everything righteous and holy. I'm starting to think he actually made a mistake. Did he actually make a mistake?
Okay, let's talk about that for a moment. For weeks now, I've been asking the question, did God know the fall was coming? if he knew the fall was coming, and he was, what you just said, omnipotent, so he had the power and the ability to stop it if he wanted to, if he didn't stop the fall and he knew it was coming, is it a mistake?
No.
Remember that all of God's creation and everything God does has one central purpose. Do you know what that purpose is? His glory. God is in the enterprise of glorifying himself. Now, if he is going to glorify his son by giving his son a people, if he just gives his son holy, righteous people, they don't need a savior. Right? But if he creates beings who he knows are going to fall into corruption and then only can get into his presence by the grace and sacrifice of him and his son, then those people are going to worship him forever, and he gets the goal, which was his glorification, right?
All right.
So then that's not a mistake, is it? Yeah, there's a purpose to all of it.
Sorry, carry
on. Okay, well, thank you, I will. And that's the thing we've got to understand about God. If you understand that God is in fact sovereign, then everything that happens in this lifetime has a purpose. I'll ask you a question, James. Mm-hmm. It's trigonometry, so I hope you're ready. No. If God is in charge, why do people get sick? Especially Christian people, people who we know he loves.
God works in mysterious ways.
He works in mysterious ways. But we have to assume then, since everything God does has purpose, we have to assume that even the bad stuff that happens in our lifetime has purpose, right? Well, then you can take that out to its furthest extreme and say, well, then everything that happens among mankind and on the planet has purpose. And the purpose always goes back to God's purpose of glorifying himself.
All right, then answer me this question. I know we gotta get to the subject, but this is really boggling me. Say God had blessed two parents with a child who was sickly, sick in the mind from the beginning of birth.
Mm-hmm.
What's the purpose then? I know it's a hard question, but...
No, it's okay. I can answer that question. Fortunately, because we have a sovereign God, we can answer that question. The people who have a lesser God can't answer that question. The sovereign God is able to prove that he can save anybody he wants by his grace, and that the finished work of Christ can save a person who gets so old that they don't remember their own name anymore. If salvation was dependent on you being able to maintain your faith until you die, and then you got, say, Alzheimer's disease, and you didn't know who you were or where you were, then you end up in God's judgment simply by the fact that you got this disease, that you had nothing to do. How cruel of God to then have to condemn you because you couldn't keep up your faith. But the God of the Bible is the God who can save somebody who doesn't know their own name. He can save a child who can't ever really grasp faith.
Someone in a coma.
He can save whoever he wants because the finished work of Christ is sufficient to save all those God chooses to save. And I think, since Paul argues in Romans that he can, from the same lump, make one vessel unto honor and another unto dishonor, that God is in that process of saving the wretches of the earth.
The base and weak things.
The base and weak things. Well then, if he can save someone as depraved as me, and also save a child who has so many mental handicaps that they can't even grasp who Jesus is, think what glorious vessels of God's grace they are when they get to stand in his presence whole and complete and healed, and God will be able to say, these people could not save themselves. Everything was working against them. I saved them completely and utterly by my grace. I think that's a huge trophy to God's grace.
And it got me teary-eyed.
And on the other side of that, too, you know, you see God's faithfulness and the truthfulness of his word when he warns of the consequences of sin in the world.
Yeah.
And it leaves the world in a tailspin, groaning until the day of redemption.
Yeah.
And we see the effects of the fall in all kinds of ways. Mm-hmm. In in various degrees in our lives.
That's true.
Not the least of which is that we have to get up and go to work every day.
Yeah, and as John Piper has mentioned a few times, you know, this is one way that God gets our attention.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, sir, Larry.
I have a son that's 15 months old that was diagnosed with liver cancer this last year. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I can say, that's something that you kick against as a parent, seeing children suffer, especially when you're children. But God uses those things, like for me, he's used it in a way that I'm a lot more humble and close to him than I used to be too. And you see his mercy and grace in that too. And it's a tough, you know, those are tough questions.
I bet.
But when you live that, it becomes not just theological talk and things like that. When you really live that, that's why the theology is so important, is because you've got a sovereign God that really nobody else can offer you that with. If it's an accident, you're hopeless. But when you can see the purpose going through that, I mean, honestly, you become a lot closer to God. And you know, we fail a lot during those situations too, and there's grace even there. I mean, it's just everywhere. It really is. It's an amazing thing. So,
that's pretty well put, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I'm done here tonight. We can close up and go home now. Yeah, Carol.
Yeah, I totally understand where you're coming from. I lost a child at 7 weeks of age, and it really does humble you, and you either go toward God or you go the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And in my situation, the day he died, I went to the Bible.
Yeah.
So there's...
David is called a man after God's own heart in the Bible. And the baby he had with Bathsheba, God took from him. So you've got to recognize that a sovereign God brings those kind of trials into the lives of people he loves. And David wrote in the Psalms, "Blessed men go through valleys of weeping." That's a reality in the blessed life. It doesn't mean that God has turned from you. It means that somewhere in his purpose, this valley serves his purpose.
And I just want to add one thing too, and also my son is fine. He had a tumor the size of a baseball in his liver when he weighed 19 pounds.
Oh my.
Now he's cancer free.
Oh,
so what, you know, he's fine and everything's fine. And I wasn't saying that. The reason, you know, there's grace there as well. And sometimes God does choose to heal and other times he doesn't. But when you're in the middle of that valley there, you realize your own mortality. There's just a lot of things that happen to you there. And you really do realize that he is God's child first. And that's something that you can say in theory, but when you get down right down to it, you realize, you know, this is God's child, and as his father, I kicked against that, you know, wondering all those questions, but there was an amazing peace that God gave me too, in the middle of it, when I finally stopped kicking, and not my will, but thy will be done.
There you
and
go.
Unless you experience that, I just, you know, I hope everybody can experience that, you know. God is very merciful.
Yeah, I'm glad you gave us the rest of that. Todd came in tonight and he sat down. The first thing he said to me is, "It's just good to be among the people of God." Isn't it good to be among the people of God right now?
Amen.
Yeah. I might not even teach. I'm just enjoying this. Just people testifying to the mercy and grace of God. That's good stuff. Yes, ma'am.
Normally I wouldn't interject here, but it just seems relevant that, you know, I don't have my own children, and I now have two teenage daughters. And Rick, of course...
And you are in our prayers constantly.
Yes. But it is a great blessing. But
sure.
I was just explaining to Rick today that you know, sometimes it's an amazing thing that two children come into your life.
Mm-hmm.
And you're thinking, I can handle this. This is tolerable. What you don't expect is, I love these girls.
Yeah.
And the reason I bring it up is because one of the lessons I've learned, sorry, doing James's thing here, but one of the lessons I've learned is, and I continue to learn, is that we aren't here to have our children love us or like us. We're here to honor God. And in doing that, sometimes you get hurt, or sometimes you hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just an amazing thing to see the grace that he wants us to have. Thank you. wants us to have with anyone. I mean, but particularly mm-hmm. with children.
Yeah.
When you're talking about either they're ill or they're
right.
ill-behaved. But that grace doesn't extend so far that you coddle them and don't teach them what the Lord has in the Bible
right.
for us to teach. And I guess the point being that regardless of what our emotions are, or our affections, our pain when a child is sick, or our perturbation when a child is not behaved, we still have to keep going back to His grace for us. I mean, it helps
right.
us to recognize first that
right.
we're His children and we're misbehaving a lot of
right.
the time. But also our job, our mission on this earth is to carry out His word.
Yeah.
And in doing that, we have to suffer.
There's a lot of responsibility that goes with it.
A reminder, too, that you don't have to be a step-parent for your children to behave as if they're not your own.
Oh. How true, how true.
Well, to wrap this up, can I talk about Silas for a moment?
Sure.
Okay, because Jennifer and I talk about this a lot, because there's a common thread here. James was diagnosed autistic many years ago, and we've dealt with that through the years, and our confidence in Christ and the sufficiency of His sacrifice is what gave us the strength to go through all the things we've had to go through. And then we met the Youngs right about the time that I was thinking, boy, you know, this burden I carry for my son, and they have a Down syndrome child. And Jennifer and I talk about it a lot, that the weak God, the Arminian God, who's waiting around for somebody to choose Him, who's waiting around for somebody to exercise sufficient faith to save him, those people have nothing to offer Silas. And no hope for Jeff and Jennifer as parents, because all they can say is, gee, it's a shame that your son won't ever know who Jesus is and can't ever choose Him. Gee, that's a shame. Whereas the absolutely sovereign God who saves who He wants by His grace and not by anything within us can save Silas as easily as He can save me or Todd. Probably easier, because Todd and I got stuff to answer for.
Oh, so does Silas.
So does Silas. All right. So then, with all of that, do I have to convince you that God looked upon the earth and behold, it was corrupt and all flesh had corrupted His way upon the earth? Are we pretty much agreed that from God's perspective, mankind deserved what they got? And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them from the earth. Make thee an ark of gopher wood. The fact is, now your different translations might have cypress wood or cedar wood. It's an old Hebrew word there that's kind of been lost to antiquity. They know it's some kind of wood, but gopher wood is what the King James went with. Rooms you will make in the ark for it. And oddly enough, the word rooms there is actually a Hebrew word for nests, which I think is kind of interesting. Little areas where animals can nest. And you shall pitch it within and without with pitch. Now this is a Hebrew word that in English letters is kafar. The Hebrew language is obviously not as complex or as varied a language as the Greek language. The New Testament written in Greek, the Old Testament predominantly in Hebrew, and so some words take on more than one meaning. And kafar is one of those words. It is used as a covering, a pitch, a sealant. It's used when Moses' mother put the baby Moses in an ark, and she covered the ark with pitch and sailed him off down the Nile. But it's also the word, oddly enough, that is used for atonement in the Old Testament. And so it is the word for covering, and that covering becomes the concept of atonement for sin, or covering for sin. So it's a word that is also used in the sacrifice of animals. When Moses in the law was told that he could put his hands on an animal, and that animal then became a sacrifice, and that sacrifice atoned for sins, that atonement activity utilized this same word, kafar. And so because of that, preachers, and by preachers I mean, you know, folks who like to grab a concept and run, have gotten a hold of that and said, well, then the ark was covered with atonement, I don't believe that's what Moses was trying to say. Instead, what Moses was saying is, God told Noah, you're going to cover it with a pitch, with a covering, and then that concept of covering and sealing moved into theological language so that we could better understand what it was God did for us sacrificially. As soon as Adam and Eve sinned, as soon as there was the first sinner, there was the first sacrifice. Adam and Eve got to work making up their little aprons to cover up their nakedness. And God comes to them and says, where are you? What have you done? Did you eat from that tree? They all have their excuses. He says, it's the woman's fault. The woman says, it's the serpent's fault. God hands out judgment on all of them, holds them all responsible for their activity. And then it says that God made animal skins and covered them. So the sign of their sinfulness was their recognition that they were naked. First thing they did was get busy trying to cover their own nakedness. And so then God covered their nakedness, and he did it with animal skins, which means he killed an animal. So as soon as there was sin, there was atoning work being done. There was death, there was bloodshed, because for sin, something has to die. And God right away was teaching substitutionary atonement. And so that concept is now being broadened, I believe, where the ark is concerned. And God said, you're going to cover it with a covering, and you're going to seal it with this covering. And everybody who's safe and going to go through the judgment is going to be inside this ark, and they're going to be sealed, and they're going to be covered, and they're going to be okay in the judgment. And I do think it's a fair game to carry that into what God has done for us in the atoning work, that he has sealed us and that he has covered us. And that's why Paul could write that we are not appointed to wrath. We're never going to fall under the wrath of God because we've been sealed and we've been covered. And so to that degree, I think the ark carries that typology. Verse 15. And this is the fashion which you shall make of it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, the breadth 50 cubits, the height 30 cubits. A cubit's basically 18 inches more or less. So we're talking about 450 feet long. Is that what most of your calculations have? 75 feet wide. Is that about right? Yep. 45 feet high.
That's it.
I didn't just do that in my head. Anybody who was impressed by that, I memorized it.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Now, all these pictures that you see in children's books of Noah and the ark, they always make it like a boat. Like it's a speedboat, like he would throw a motor on the back and, you know, go cruising through the water. He was not building a boat. He was building an ark, and an ark is always a box. If you think about the Ark of the Covenant, if you think about the ark that Moses was put in, we're always talking about a box. And because it was long and very wide, but much longer and wider than it was high, it would have a very low center of gravity. As a result, it would be able to ride out the storm without capsizing, because it was very low and very wide. And it had three stories of nests. Oh, by the way, here's another one of those things that we all grew up with, as long as I'm talking about the Bible stories that we teach our kids. We all know this one. How many animals were taken on the ark?
Two of each.
Two of each. We all think that, don't we? Yeah, we all think two of each kind. You know, that's not right. You know that, right? Among the unclean animals, you took two. But among what God calls the clean animals, he says, take seven. We're about to read that. See, look at the way your eyes light up. Like, really? Seven? Never knew that. Isn't that odd? We should teach our children these right, correct stories and say, you know, it wasn't a speedboat. You know, they weren't skiing off the back of it, you know, and they were. It was a box. It was an ark and all of the typology that the covering of the ark has. And then point out that there were seven. Why seven clean animals?
For sacrifice.
Very good. Now, wait a minute. A minute ago, you didn't even know there were seven, and you got the answer right. Yeah. First off, we'll wait until she stops glorying in her correct answer. First off, the clean animals were allowable for food. So that meant that once the ark landed, you would want more of those animals for food, because if there were only two of the animals that were used for food and you ate one of them, you better really enjoy that meal, because that animal's done now. and also for sacrifice. As soon as Moses gets off the boat, he sacrifices. Now, to me, that just speaks loud and clear, because Cain and Abel, you've only got four people on the planet. You've got Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, and the dividing point between Cain and Abel was that they each brought a sacrifice. Where did human beings this early on get this idea that God wanted sacrifices? Why did human beings right away, as soon as there was sin, start bringing things to God, start bringing sacrifice to God?
And he killed them to clothe them.
Yes, that he killed an animal to clothe them. I mean, right away, God is teaching sacrifice. And that concept of sacrifice never, never changes in the Bible, that God expects sacrificial response for everything that he has done. The difference is that in the New Covenant, in the New Testament, Paul now says that everything you have and everything you are ought to be sacrificed, and writes in Romans 12 that you are now to bring your body to God as a living sacrifice. Brand new idea, because sacrifice always meant dead. Sacrifice always meant kill. It always meant blood. And he said, now that we've come to God through Christ, this new living way, that we are to bring our bodies to God as living sacrifices. And then he uses this wonderful phrase where he says, which is your reasonable service. Like, God isn't asking anything unreasonable of you, to expect everything from you and to expect that your whole life would be laid down in front of God, a living sacrifice, which is your reasonable service. And by the way, as long as I'm on it, the word reasonable there is the Greek word from which we get logic. He says, this is just logical, that if God has done everything he's done for you, then he has every right to expect everything from you. And that concept goes all the way back here, Cain and Abel, bring to God. And God, preparing for that, says, take two of each animal, but take seven of the clean ones. And then Noah gets off the boat, and the first thing he does is sacrifice to God. Sacrifice is a constant through the Bible. Carol.
What's the significance of seven?
Seven is the number of completion. I don't put a whole lot of stock in biblical numerology, but there are certain numbers in the Bible that play out so consistently. Seven is the number of completion. Six is the number of man. One is the number of God always. You take the number of man, which is six. You take the one that is God. You put them together, you get completion, seven. Throughout the book of Revelation, seven is used as a number of completion. There are certain numbers like that. Five is almost always a number of grace throughout the Bible. Two, the number of adequate witness. Three is the number of the Trinity. Those you can see play out pretty consistently. So that's the significance of seven. Verse 17, I think, is where we are. No, verse 16. We may not get to the wow moment tonight, just so you know, which means you'll have to come back next week. So, yes, ma'am.
What does the number four mean? Because you went 1 through 7, you didn't say...
I'm sorry, four is usually the number of the whole earth. The four winds, the four compass points, the four corners of the earth, all of that is used consistently of number four.
Thank you.
Okay, no problem. Verse 16, a window shalt thou make in the ark, and in a cubit you shall finish it above. So it was a window up above, not on the sides. And the door of the ark you shall set in the side thereof. With lower, second, and third stories you will make it. And behold, I, even I, do bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh, wherein is the breath of life from under heaven, and everything that is in the earth shall die. But with thee will I establish my covenant. The reason that is so important is it's the first place in the Bible where the word covenant is stated. Now, when we were back in Genesis 3, we got to Genesis 3:15, and we talked about the fact that people posit a theological covenant there, and they'll talk about a theological covenant that predates all of human history. They talk about the covenant made between the Father and the Son, that the Son would be the Lamb slain, and that he would come and sacrifice himself in exchange for which he would have a people and the Father would glorify him, all of which is true, that that plays out in history, but I don't like using biblical theological terminology like covenant for things the Bible doesn't identify as a covenant. And since Genesis 3:15 doesn't say covenant, no, I don't say covenant there. Here we find the first use of the word covenant. Now, covenant at its root, the word that is translated covenant at its root there means to cut. And so covenants normally were established by two people making a deal, slicing open an animal, and then the two parties of the covenant would walk through the sliced animal together, the agreement being if either side didn't keep their part of the deal, what happened to the animal, what happened to them. That's got some motivation there. See, if banks did that, they'd get paid back more often. But with you I establish my covenant, and you shall come into the ark, you and thy sons and thy wife and thy sons' wives with thee. Now it says that Noah was an upright man, and it says that Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. How lucky were these guys to happen to be related to Noah? Especially the wives, who just married into the family. It's like, hey, guess what? Everybody's going to die, and you married my son, you get to live. Boy, that's a big benefit to marrying into that family. This is clearly an act of grace on God's part, because you don't hear, and Ham and Shem and Japheth and their wives were all really good, upstanding, righteous people. You don't hear that. And in fact, like I said, we're going to discover later that Ham isn't that great a guy and is going to fall, he and his descendants, under a curse from God. And yet God takes these eight people and is going to start over with all of humanity by his grace. Verse 19, and of every living thing of all flesh, two of every sort shalt thou bring into the ark to keep them alive with thee, and they shall be male and female, of fowls after their kind, and of cattle after their kind, and of every creeping thing of the earth after his kind, two of every sort shall come unto thee to keep them alive. That's very interesting language. Because God didn't say, now you need to go out and find two of every animal, which is the way it's so often pictured. Noah out there calling, you know, like, come on. Yeah, exactly. Roping and bringing them in. Instead, God says, they'll come to you. I will bring them to you. Because we have to understand the impossibility of any man being able to corral two of every kind of animal and get them onto a boat. Clearly something miraculous has to take place, but God said that right from the beginning, that it would be miraculous. Two of every sort shall come to you, which had to have been quite amazing to his neighbors. Because for 120 years, he's building an ark. 120 years. And he's saying things like, it's going to rain. It's never rained. The canopy is still up there. The firmament still exists. Early in Genesis, we already read that there was a mist that came up out of the earth, and that's how it watered the whole earth. And so he says, flood coming. They go, I don't even know what that is. Rain coming. Don't know what rain is. 120 years testifying, God's judgment's coming. Nobody's paying attention. Perhaps once in a while they're checking with Methuselah to see if he's still alive, given his name, which means when he dies, it comes. So they're going in and going, you feeling okay today? Well, we got nothing to worry about. Methuselah dies, and they start seeing animals collecting over there at the Noah property. These were huge signs to folks that the judgment of God was afoot. And what you don't read anywhere in the Genesis account is that anybody repented. Isn't that amazing? You got 120 years of a guy prophesying with this enormous boat he's building, and it's prophesying judgment's coming. And then animals start collecting. Judgment's coming. And he says, it's going to rain. Judgment's coming.
Nobody uses their free will to join Noah?
And nobody utilized their free will to come get on the boat with Noah. Instead, he gets in, God closes the door, and the rain starts falling, and mankind is wiped out. And never once does it say, and when the rain started falling, men realized the hand of God, and they repented. You would think that if all it took to get somebody to accept God was adequate motivation, this is really good motivation. And nobody does it. So, verse 21, and you shall take unto thee of all food that is eaten, and you shall gather it to thee, and it shall be for food for thee and for them. Thus did Noah, according to all that God commanded him, so he did. Now, when we talk about food and the amount of food he took in, do you know how long they were actually on the ark? Have you ever done the math? A year and 10 days. 40 days and 40 nights of rain, 40 days and 40 nights of the flood, but then they had to wait for the floodwaters to abate. And then they finally end up on a mountaintop. And then they still can't get out because the mountaintop is there, but the rest of the earth is still covered with water. So even when the ark settles, they stay in it for another month, just waiting for enough dry ground to get out. 1 year and 10 days, they're in a box full of animals. And they got to bring enough food for that. Yeah, I see your faces. I mean, put flesh and blood on that. And you're talking about a guy, he's 600 years old when the rain starts coming. You don't think 6 months into this enterprise, he was a little weary of the whole thing? Three stories of animals, and you're rocking and rolling on the water, and I can't even imagine. I can't even fathom it. So chapter 7 starts, and the Lord said unto Noah, come, you and all your house into the ark, for you have I seen righteous before me in this generation, of every clean beast. See this? Of every clean beast you shall take unto thee by sevens, the male and his female, and of beasts that are not clean take by two, the male and his female. Of the fowls also of the air by sevens, the male and the female, to keep seed alive upon the face of all the earth. For yet 7 days, and I will cause it to rain upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights, and every living substance that I have made will I destroy from off the face of the earth. And Noah did according to all that the Lord commanded him, and Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters was upon the earth. He started building this thing when he was 480 years old. And 120 years later, you got to figure that maybe 60, 70 years into this thing, he's starting to go, you know, God, I know you said you were going to be doing something here, but I'm knocking out a boat over here. When are we doing this? 120 years. Do you have that kind of patience? Especially if God tells you, I'm going to judge the whole earth and save you. I know there are some of us who our natural human ego is like, all right, you do that, God. You save me and you wipe these people out. And then you got to wait 120 years of walking around telling people, I'm telling you. He's going to do it. 80, 90 years into that, you know there were people coming over going, oh yeah, when? You know, we've been waiting, not seeing that judgment thing. He has to keep building against all odds, believing that God is going to do it. Finally, God says, okay, 7 more days, and I'm going to do it. He gives him a week's warning, and I'm going to do this. 40 days and 40 nights, I'm going to destroy everything. Noah did according unto all that the Lord commanded him. And Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters was upon the earth. And Noah went in, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him into the ark because of the waters of the flood. Of clean beasts and of beasts that are not clean and of fowls and of everything that creepeth upon the earth, they went in two and two unto Noah into the ark. That's the hand of God. It doesn't say Noah went out there and got him by twos and roped him in there. Can you imagine this parade? God just bringing animals into the ark. The male and the female, as God had commanded Noah. And it came to pass after 7 days that the waters of the flood were upon the earth in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, the same day were all of the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were open, and the rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. Now, it's very interesting that Moses, who probably wrote Genesis by all best accounts, so he would have been writing roughly 1,400 years prior to Christ, but he's writing about what happened during the time of Noah, and he starts setting dates. He tells us that it happened in the 600th year of Noah's life in the second month on the 17th day of the month. That's awfully specific if he's just trying to pass on a legend. But he's also setting you up for something. So let's see if I can get to it and then we'll call it a night. Because this is great. In the selfsame day entered Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth and the sons of Noah and Noah's wife and his three sons of his wife. All of them went into the ark, they and every beast after his kind and all the cattle after their kind and every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth after his kind and every fowl after his kind, every bird of every sort. And they went in unto Noah into the ark, two and two of all flesh, wherein is the breath of life. And they that went in male and female of all flesh, as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. So God closed the door, sealed it up. And the flood was 40 days upon the earth, and the waters increased, and it bore up the ark, and it was lifted up above the earth, and the waters prevailed, and were increased greatly upon the earth, and the ark went upon the face of the waters. And the water prevailed exceedingly upon the earth, and all the high hills that were under the whole heaven were covered. 15 cubits upward did the water prevail, and the mountains were covered. And all flesh died that moved upon the earth, both of fowls and of cattle and of beasts and of every creeping thing that creeps on the earth and every man, all in whose nostrils was the breath of life, and all that was in the dry land died. And every living substance was destroyed which was upon the face of the ground, both man and cattle and creeping things and the fowls of the heavens, and they were destroyed from the earth, and Noah only remained alive, and they that were with him in the ark, and the waters prevailed upon the earth for 150 days. And God remembered Noah and every living thing and all the cattle that were in the ark, and God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters were assuaged. The fountains also of the deep and the windows of heaven were stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained, and the waters returned from off the earth continually, and after the end of 150 days, the waters were abated. And the ark rested, this is fascinating, and the ark rested in the seventh month of the 17th day of the month upon the mountains of Ararat, which is in the Caucasus Mountains. Why did Moses bother to tell us that on the 17th day of the seventh month the ark rested, other than to tell us how long the flood went? Why that date? Now you got to do a little bit of Bible history. In Moses' time, Moses would have been working from a civil calendar. And so when he wrote about the seventh month, he would have been writing about what was classically known as the Hebrew civil calendar, which was borrowed from the Egyptian and Babylonian calendars around them. But during the time of the Exodus, which Moses led, God told Moses that on a certain night, they were all going to eat a meal. They were going to eat a Passover lamb together. Every family was going to sacrifice a lamb, and they were going to eat it in haste. And they were going to eat it fully dressed, with their shoes on, with their staff in hand, ready to go. And he said, you're going to do that on the 14th day of this month, which was the month of Nisan, which was the seventh month of the civil calendar. And God very specifically says to them in the Exodus, now this month will be the first month for your calendar. And God takes the month of Nisan and moves it to the beginning of the Hebrew calendar, so it becomes known as the Hebrew religious calendar. And all of the feasts that God gives them at Mount Sinai are all determined by this religious calendar. On the 14th day of the month of Nisan, which is now the first month of their year, which was the seventh month of the Babylonian and Egyptian and then Hebrew civil calendars, on the 14th day of the month, they would all eat the Passover, which means that on the 14th, Jesus ate the Passover. Now, you know that I have argued many, many times that Jesus was actually in the grave 72 hours, 3 days and 3 nights. He himself said that that was the way it was going to work. Jesus did not die on a Friday. He died on a Wednesday, and he was in the tomb all day Thursday, all day Friday, all day Saturday. Saturday at 6 o'clock or the evening is the beginning of the first day of the week, and the beginning of the first day of the week, it very clearly says, is the day that Jesus rose out of the grave. What day would that have been? The exact same day that the ark came to rest on Mount Ararat. Now, do you think that's a mistake?
Wow.
Wow!
I was the one that said that.
Isn't that remarkable? Now, think with me for a moment, because sometimes people will say, well, you know, the Bible's a concoction of old wives' tales. Moses wrote this 1400 years before Jesus came to the planet. And he exactly marked the date of the resurrection. And God marked it by making that the day that the people who were under the covering came to rest. Oh, well, I don't have to work very hard on that one. Because many years later, Christ came to earth, who is our covering, who is our atonement. And he went into the grave, and on the very same day, he got up out of the tomb, and all of God's people ceased from their works and ceased from their turmoil and ceased from the judgment, and we all rested in the finished work of Christ. And Moses wrote about that 1,400 years before the fact, talking about something that happened 3,000 years before the fact, and God made sure to keep the record. See, I've often said that if I didn't worship the God of this Bible, I'd have to worship the men who figured out how to write it. Yeah, because that's just too remarkable. So way back there in Noah's time, and then later in Moses' time, God was being very specific to say, I'm still God, I'm still in charge, and I am going to tell you way in advance, I'm going to preach way in advance the same message over and over again. My grace is how people get saved, and you get saved when you are atoned for, you get saved when I've covered you, and that brings about rest. And so Noah and his family came to rest. And that makes me want to say, wow. Yeah. Same story, same preachment all the way through the Bible. It just keeps getting said over and over again, God's trying to tell you something, which is the only rest you're going to have with him is in Christ and in his finished work. It's never going to be in your works, never going to be in your fig leaves, never going to be in your efforts, never going to be when you bring, like Cain did, the offering of your own hands. I mean, what are we, Genesis 8, and how much of the same consistent theology have we seen over and over again? You can't bring the stuff of your hands or your works to God and expect him to accept them. He keeps preaching, I'm sufficient, I will do it, I will save you, I'll atone for you, I'll bring you to rest, I do all that. And I'll do it in the midst of judgment. He can judge the whole earth and at the same time bring rest to his people. That's that same message over and over and over again. He's been saying it ever since there were humans. You'd think at some point we'd believe him. Right? All right. Thank you all for your comments tonight. What a good time of sharing we had tonight.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.